This is AWLS, podcasts on wilderness medicine from the University of Utah School of Medicine.
Hello again, and welcome back to the AWLS podcast. My name is Matt Gunderson. I am a pediatric emergency physician at the University of New Mexico. Today, we are completing our three-part series about Hymenoptera. The series started several months ago with an episode about ants, with a specific focus on fire ants. More recently, we talked about bees with a detailed discussion about killer bees. And now, it is time to finish the series with an episode about wasps, with a particular interest in the so-called murder hornets that have been making headlines in the news in Canada and the United States over the past few years. One more quick review. Hymenoptera is an order of insects that includes ants, bees, and wasps, and all of those families have several things in common, both in terms of body anatomy and also social structures, how they live and function together, as we have talked about in previous episodes. Importantly, from a wilderness medicine standpoint, all females in this order of insects have an ovipositor for laying eggs that can also be used to sting other organisms, such as humans. Statistically speaking, stings from Hymenoptera cause more deaths per year in the United States than any other type of envenomation, more than snakes, more than spiders, and more than scorpions. Bees and wasps are very similar in many ways, but they are different families of insects. As we discussed previously, bees are in the Apidae family, and structurally their bodies are relatively fat and fuzzy compared to wasps, and they are relatively docile compared to wasps. They usually only sting in self-defense, or what they perceive to be self-defense. In general, they are vegetarians that feed on pollen and nectar, and as we talked about before, they are enormously important for human food supplies due to their major role in plant pollination. Wasps, on the other hand, are in the Vespidae family. The family includes hornets and yellow jackets and several other types of wasps. There are nearly 5,000 different species within the family, and the number will keep growing as scientists discover more and more of them. Their bodies are usually more narrow and smooth compared to bees. Generally speaking, wasps are more aggressive than most bees, although many insect experts will point out that humans are not part of the wasp food chain, so in theory, if you leave them alone, just like bees, they should leave you alone, but many people who have been stung after accidental encounters with wasps will tell you that they seem to have a very low threshold to sting. And because their stingers are relatively smooth, they are very able, and sometimes very willing, to sting you multiple times. And relative to bees, even a single sting from a wasp can be extremely painful. Which makes sense, wasps being more aggressive and having stronger stings, because they are predators. They do feed a lot on plant material, including nectar and tree sap and certain kinds of fruits. But they also eat many other kinds of insects, including bees, which can be a problem for humans if they destroy too many honeybee hives and thus decrease our food supplies. Wasps do contribute a small amount to plant pollination themselves, but not even remotely close to bees. Wasps can also contribute to human society in keeping some pest populations under control, so there is definitely some good and some bad about wasps from a human perspective. The most common species of wasps in the United States are paper wasps and yellow jackets. Paper wasps are named after the hives they build, which feature open combs and are made of a mixture of saliva and wood fibers, which create a papery substance. They are commonly seen, but less aggressive than yellow jackets. So if you are stung by a wasp, statistically, it is much more likely to be a yellow jacket, at least here in the United States. We will talk about presentation, evaluation, and management of wasp stings later in this podcast. Of note, paper wasps and yellow jackets can be difficult to tell apart for people who are not insect experts, and also they are both somewhat similar in size and appearance to honeybees, and given that those three species are among the most commonly encountered by humans, they are the most frequently confused for each other. So whenever a patient reports being stung by a bee, but seems to be having a little more pain than you would expect from a single bee sting, consider the possibility that the culprit is actually a wasp, and then consider the possibility that the person was stung more than once, because wasps can do that. hornets are a subfamily of wasps. They are very closely related to yellow jackets, but they tend to be larger overall and tend to have darker coloration rather than the bright yellow, which is characteristic of yellow jackets. They have a relatively larger vertex of the head, which is the area between the eyes, and a more rounded gaster, which is the front portion of the abdomen closest to the waist. There are no species of hornets that are native to North America, but the European hornet has been accidentally introduced by humans as far back as the 1800s and is now well established on the continent. Some other species of hornets have been found in Canada and the United States on a few occasions, likely accidentally imported, and we will talk more about some of them in just a few minutes. But the European hornet is the only true hornet currently living in the wild in North America in large numbers. Of note, the bald-faced hornet is found here, but it's not actually a hornet, but it is a wasp. It has traditionally been called a hornet because of its size, which is somewhat bigger than most other wasps, which makes it more similar to many species of hornets. And you may have noticed a trend if you've listened to the past episodes about Hymenoptera. In each one, we have featured an invasive species with a very aggressive-sounding name invading the United States. First, we talked about fire ants. Then we talked about killer bees. And now, today, we shall discuss the infamous murder hornets. The scientific name for the murder hornet is Vespa mandarinia. They got tagged with the murder hornet nickname in America due to a New York Times article, more specifically the headline for the article, which ran back in 2020. It is obviously sensationalist, like many headlines nowadays in the online news media world, with the goal of grabbing attention, getting lots of people to click on the article, and maybe make it go viral, which it eventually did. Most of the scientific community does not like the nickname, and understandably so. They see it as alarmist and inflammatory and overall fairly inaccurate. The official common name for the murder hornet that you will see in most printed material is the Asian giant hornet. More recently, there has been a movement among some experts to change the name to the northern giant hornet. The reality is the general public usually doesn't care what insect scientists decide at their insect meetings, and so pretty much everyone, including me, will probably just continue calling them murder hornets from now until forever. They are native to Japan, and they are probably still more concentrated in Japan than anywhere else in the world, so much of the research and information about them comes from Japan. In fact, Japanese media have been calling them murder hornets in their language, Japanese, obviously, as far back as 2008, so it's not just an American thing. The statistics indicate that the hornets are responsible for 30 to 50 deaths per year in Japan. That number is small compared to the overall population of Japan, but the risk is not insignificant, especially for people who live in rural parts of Japan and spend a lot of time outdoors. Japan, by the way, an extremely underrated destination for outdoor adventures. I think most people, most Americans anyways, when we hear about Japan, we think about Tokyo, a giant city with skyscrapers and neon signs everywhere and comic book cafes, and you go to a restaurant and your waiter is a robot, things like that. And that stuff is there and it can be a lot of fun. But Japan also has beautiful forests and amazing mountains, some of the best hiking in the world. And of course, a lot of people love the skiing and snowboarding there. So if you ever have the chance to visit Japan, you should definitely do it, and you should absolutely spend some time outdoors while you're there. Just to keep an eye out for the murder hornets. They seem to have originated in Japan, but have now spread all over East Asia, as far west as India, with a north-south distribution ranging from Russia all the way down to places like Vietnam. They have proven themselves very capable of thriving in temperate and tropical climates. Interestingly, in Japan, their nests are almost exclusively found underground, especially within tree root systems. Outside of Japan, their nests have been found above ground, within hollow tree trunks, for example, but rarely over 6 feet above ground. Researchers are still trying to figure out exactly why this variation exists in different locations. In contrast, European hornets build their nests over 6 feet above ground much more frequently. So if you see a nest attached to the roof of a barn, for example, it is extremely unlikely to be murder hornets, especially anywhere outside of East Asia. What do they look like? Referring to the murder hornets. They are the largest species of hornet on Earth. Queens can have bodies longer than 2 inches with a 3-inch wingspan, although you are less likely to see a queen outside the hive. Drones and workers are about 1.5 inches long. Queens and workers have stingers that are about 1/4 inch long, which is long enough to puncture a lot of standard beekeeping suits. They have heads that are light orange in color with a single black tooth attached to their mandibles that is used for digging. The thorax is usually dark brown, and the abdomen has stripes that alternate between dark brown or black and light orange or yellow. Hornets in general are tough insects, and murder hornets in particular are the biggest and toughest of them all. There have been various studies monitoring them as they interact with other wasps and other species of insects in various situations, and overall the murder hornets dominate in most scenarios, which usually ends with the other species surrendering and flying away. In one study, researchers observed fights between murder hornets and various other species. So it was kind of a little fight club for insects. Of course, the first rule of Fight Club is don't talk about Fight Club. But this one is worth talking about because the murder hornets won 56 out of 57 fights. And in case you were wondering, the only defeat of a murder hornet was against a species of butterfly, which I was not expecting. I don't know what happened there. Like, did the butterfly pull out a tiny little weapon and start waving it around? I don't know. But overall, the murder hornets had a winning percentage of 98.3%, which certainly deserves the undisputed world championship belt for the insect's heavyweight division. Like most species of insects, murder hornets are much more active during warmer months. In fact, in colder climates, almost all hornets die out during the winter season, with only the queens hibernating and surviving to start new colonies every spring. And so the risk of being stung is much higher during the summer and early fall months and drops to essentially zero during winter months. This can become a problem when a place experiences warmer than usual weather. In China in 2013, the Shaanxi province experienced a particularly long, hot, dry summer, and that resulted in a massive uptick in murder hornet attacks. 42 people died, and another 1,675 people were significantly injured. Similar to killer bees, there were reports of massive swarms and people being stung countless times. Farm workers were the most common victims, but there were also more horrifying stories like a school full of children in a rural village being attacked. But as terrible as these attacks are, they are relatively rare, and humans overall get off fairly lightly compared to the insects that hornets actually target as predators. Just like we have talked about with other stinging insects, and also scorpions and spiders and snakes, we are not part of their food chain. They do not wake up in the morning hoping to have encounters with humans. In all cases, they perceive that we are more of a threat to them than they are to us, and in some ways, they are probably not wrong in thinking this. But for hornets, honeybees are a different story. Hornets see honeybees as a valuable source of food, and they will actively seek them out and kill them individually, and also destroy entire honeybee colonies. And this is actually where murder hornets and most other hornets are most dangerous to human society. Their predatory behavior against honeybees can be very disruptive towards, number one, honey production, and number two, and much more important, their activity as major plant pollinators within human food supply chains, which we have talked about before. So the bottom line is, anything that threatens honeybee populations is a very big deal, and murder hornets certainly are a major threat to honeybees wherever they spread in the world. And actually, the murder hornet method of attack against honeybees is very well documented in detail in the scientific literature, and it is very interesting. Much of this research has been done by our scientific colleagues in Japan and other parts of Asia. The attacks are divided into very specific stages. The first phase is hunting phase. Worker hornets fly out from their colonies and individually each find a colony of honeybees. The individual hornet will attack an individual honeybee just outside the hive. It is assumed that this is usually a honeybee who is guarding the hive. The hornet will use its mandibles to quickly decapitate the honeybee and then tears off its legs and wings and usually also separates the thorax from the abdomen. Of particular interest are the flying muscles on the thorax because of their high protein content. So the hornet rolls the thorax into a little meatball and discards the rest of the honeybee, then flies back to the hornet hive to feed the hornet larvae. Adult hornets don't actually eat the meat. They just chew it into kind of a protein paste and feed it to the larvae. The theory is the larvae are rapidly growing and developing, so they have the highest protein needs. The larvae then secrete a fluid that includes some combination of amino acids and carbohydrates, and that is what the adults feed on. The adults also feed on other fluids such as honey, nectar, and tree sap. Now, I'm sure these individual attacks are disturbing to the honeybees. Can you imagine if you were a security guard and you showed up for your shift and you're like, hey, where's Bob, the overnight guy? And then you look around and you're like, oh my gosh, is that his head on the ground? And are those his legs? What happened here? Right? That would be horrifying. Although we should remember that all of the bees and wasps involved would be female. But either way, absolutely horrifying. But actually, something even worse likely happened at the time of the attack. Murder hornets have a gland that secretes a chemical that marks a location with a certain scent, which they can use to return later as a group to attack and destroy the entire honeybee hive. And that is the second phase, which is called the slaughter phase. And it is every bit as terrifying as it sounds. It usually happens in the late summer or early fall, the theory being that the hornet brood is growing and developing and needing more food, while simultaneously other food sources for the hornets are depleted at that time of the year. So the adult hornets resort to attacking and destroying entire honeybee colonies. And they are very good at it. It only takes a group of 20 or 30 hornets, maybe up to 50, to conquer a honeybee hive containing thousands of honeybees, in some cases over 20,000 honeybees. And they kill the honeybees in the same way, grabbing each one and snipping its head off with their mandibles. Only instead of collecting the corpse and processing it as food, they just drop it and move on to the next bee. And a single hornet can kill 40 bees per minute this way. An entire honeybee colony can be destroyed in a matter of a few hours. Occasionally, it will take more than one day, in which case the hornets will return to their hive when the night falls, maybe have a few drinks, play some cards, get some rest, and then return the next day to finish the job. Which leads us to the third phase, which is the occupation phase. The hornets enter the hive and find the bee brood, which is their pupae and larvae, and collect it and take it back to their own colony to feed to their own brood. And they also feast on the corpses of the adult honeybees who were killed during the slaughter phase. So yeah, murder hornets are not nice neighbors. You may wonder if the honeybees have any form of defense against them. The hornets are too big and have too much body armor for the honeybees to sting them. But honeybee species in Asia, particularly in Japan, have developed a method of killing individual invading hornets. If they detect a hornet approaching their nest, Japanese honeybees will gather into a mob of 100 or 200, and they will ambush the invading hornet, and they will smother it in a ball of bees. And all of the bees flap their wings furiously, and that leads to an accumulation of heat and carbon dioxide at the center of the ball, where the hornet is. And the combination of those two, the high temperature and the high carbon dioxide level, will kill the hornet. Now, some of the bees might die also, but as any good bee will tell you, it's all for the greater good. And that is much better than allowing the invading hornet to mark their hive with a chemical scent that could later trigger a massive attack against the colony. So, Japanese honeybees are able to defend themselves to some extent, and that is probably why they have been able to live side by side with giant predator hornets for thousands of years. European honeybees, however, have not evolved in the same environment and therefore have not developed those kinds of defensive strategies. And so there is a legitimate worry that European honeybees will be in serious trouble if the dreaded murder hornets successfully invade North America. They have not done so far, but there was a temporary invasion a few years ago that is worth talking about. And as a side note, I should clarify, I keep using the word invasion, but these hornets aren't really invading anything. In their minds, they are just multiplying and spreading across the land, using the resources available to them, like many organisms do, until some force stops them from spreading out more. Humans are not so different, except we tend to pollute and destroy and alter the natural environment on a much larger scale. So it's not like the murder hornets have a little war room inside their nests, pointing at tiny maps and strategizing about how to invade North America. It is likely that humans are accidentally transporting them around against their will, or at the very least, without their consent. So what I am about to describe isn't some D-Day-style invasion landing on the West Coast. It is more like you go on a road trip with your buddies, and one of your friends falls asleep in the car, and then wakes up hours later and is like, whoa, where are we? Well, I guess I'll look around. That kind of thing. It all started for us North Americans in August 2019 on Vancouver Island, which is a large island on the west coast of Canada and part of the province of British Columbia. Local beekeepers discovered some wasps buzzing around their hives, which looked foreign to them, and they were able to kill a few and send them for identification, and they were eventually confirmed as being Asian giant hornets. Live worker hornets buzzing around made everyone suspicious that a nest had been established on the island, which would be massively problematic for reasons we have already talked about. So a small group of local beekeepers banded together and did some smart detective work, and they were able to find the nest the very next month, which is pretty incredible. Apparently one of them was stung by one of the hornets while they were out searching, which, you know, sucks for that guy. But they made the best of that encounter and followed the hornet back to its nest, which was nearby. And a group of four of them returned later with some equipment and some protection, and they were able to destroy the nest. They used a carbon dioxide fire extinguisher to subdue the hornets, then drowned them in isopropyl alcohol, which A, killed them, but then also B, preserved their dead bodies for further scientific evaluation. And they took lots of photos and video clips and got stung a few times and ultimately wrote an article about it, which was published in the American Bee Journal, February 2020 edition, if you want to look it up. It is a quick read and definitely worth a few minutes of your time. And they also posted a video about their adventure on YouTube, which is pretty cool. Overall, great work. It's like the old saying goes, not all heroes wear capes. Some are covered head to toe in beekeeping suits. That same month, September 2019, a worker hornet was spotted in the vicinity of Blaine, Washington, a small town in the extreme northwest corner of Washington State, right on the border with Canada. And over the course of the following few months, there were various isolated sightings of the hornets around that area. And at the same time, the scientific community was confirming that the nest on Vancouver Island was indeed invasive giant hornets. And so we found ourselves looking at a very worrisome reality, that there were more nests in the area of this potentially dangerous invasive species that hadn't been found by humans yet. And as we have learned in previous episodes, most species of Hymenoptera are capable of spreading very quickly. In some cases, a single colony of insects will produce hundreds of queens who can each go out and start their own individual colonies and rapidly produce thousands of their own offspring, including many more queens. So at ground zero at the U.S.-Canadian border, this became a very intense race against time. In April of 2020, the Washington State Department of Agriculture issued public alerts and announced that a, quote, full-scale hunt was underway. And I wasn't there. I don't know what it was really like. But in my mind, I am picturing that famous scene in The Fugitive movie with Tommy Lee Jones when he's like, all right, listen up, everybody. What I want is a hard target search of every farmhouse, henhouse, doghouse, inhouse, and outhouse in this county. Go get them. Something like that, only instead of being surrounded by police officers and U.S. Marshals, it was bug scientists and beekeepers and civilian volunteers. And there probably wasn't as much train wreckage in the background, I'm guessing. What a great scene, and what a great movie. If you haven't watched The Fugitive, you really need to. It is seriously one of the best movies ever. And if you haven't watched it recently, you should watch it again, especially if you are a healthcare provider. I watched it for the first time as a teenager and loved it, but much later on, when I watched it after practicing medicine for a few years, it really hits differently. You see that story in a different context, and it makes it even more interesting, I think. Okay, back to the Hornet invasion. Around May of 2020, a New York Times article labeled them murder hornets, and the article went viral, and the name stuck in the media, and thus in the minds of the general public. And with the media frenzy came thousands of reports of murder hornet sightings, almost all of them not involving any actual murder hornets. And later we'll talk briefly about a few native species that may look similar and thus be misidentified as murder hornets. And so the search continued in Washington State, powered by a coalition of national, state, and local officials, with scientists and concerned private citizens all working together. And the modern world being the way it is, most of the adventure was extensively photographed and video recorded along the way, and there was a documentary on the Discovery Channel and a series of excellent articles in National Geographic talking about the hunt and the people involved. They had hoped to do the same thing the Canadians did, find a hornet and follow it back to its nest. But early on, most hornets they encountered were either dead or too tired or too lost and confused to fly back to their colony. But eventually they caught a healthy worker hornet, attached a tiny tracking device, and fed her some strawberry jelly. And apparently that got her fired up, and she buzzed right back to the nest with the humans tracing her all the way. And the nest was found over 8 feet up in the hollow of a tree, which again was not expected because the nests are usually underground or close to the ground almost 100% of the time in Japan. But they found it. And they eventually approached it wearing extra puffy protective suits, and they were able to remove a bunch of hornets with a vacuum, actually, and then subdued the rest with carbon dioxide, and then cut the nest out of the tree trunk. And it all ended up in a giant refrigerator in a lab at Washington State University. It was estimated that there were about 500 live specimens in the hive, including 200 queens and larvae. So it was fortunate the nest was found when it was, which was October of 2020, so that the queens didn't have a chance to spread out over the winter and then start their own colonies in the spring. So the capture was extremely important in terms of preventing future spread of the murder hornets, but it was also helpful in being able to study the captured specimens. There was a brief detour when the man who owned the property upon which the nest was found asked to have it returned to him, along with most of the hornets, and that was his legal right, and he apparently put them up for sale on eBay. This angered a lot of people and put a temporary pause on the research, but ultimately the problem was solved when a local beekeeper bought the hive and all the hornets from the guy and gave it all back to state officials. And from there, specimens were distributed to scientists all over the country, and ultimately a significant portion of the collection was sent to the Smithsonian Institute for the purposes of preservation and public display. One interesting finding of the research, the hornets found in Washington State were genetically different from the hornets found in British Columbia, indicating at least two separate accidental introduction events. The specimens captured in Canada seem to originate from Japan, whereas the hornets on the United States side were a genetic match for a population in South Korea, which is so mind-boggling to me, to have two totally separate populations from different countries accidentally transported to almost the exact same place at about the exact same time. Feel free to come up with your own bioterrorism conspiracy theories. Actually, don't feel free to do that. We already have too many crazy conspiracy theories floating around as it is. But there is some good news for North America. Unlike the fire ants and killer bees, the story around the murder hornets has a happy ending, at least so far. There were three more nests found in the surrounding area in Washington State in 2021, all related to the first nest found the previous year, and all of them were destroyed. And there have been zero new nests discovered since then. There were no sightings of the hornets at all during 2022 or 2023, and of this year, 2024. ends without any sightings, the hornets will be considered officially eradicated from North America. So, crisis averted for now, thanks to the heroic efforts and cooperation of many different people. But this success has not stopped people from being freaked out about murder hornets. Across the United States, there have been thousands of calls reporting possible sightings. Some of these are understandable. We do have a few species of wasps that are similar in size to murder hornets, and they look mean and sound mean. Some reported sightings are less understandable. Many hornet species and most yellow jacket species are only about half the size of murder hornets, so we should really not be confusing them. One possible murder hornet sighting reported to local authorities ended up being a plastic toy, so that's a little embarrassing. There are some other species that are similar in size to murder hornets. In the eastern United States, there are European hornets, which we talked about earlier as being an established invasive species in North American ecosystems now, and some of them can grow quite large. There are also eastern cicada killers, a native species. In the western United States, we have western cicada killers and also tarantula hawks. And I'm not going into all the detail describing the physical characteristics of each species. There are some great resources online differentiating them from each other and from murder hornets, if you are interested in those details. Suffice it to say, they all have some different colors and body parts and shapes and sizes, etc. and so forth. Here in New Mexico, where I live, in the desert southwest region of the United States, cicada killers and tarantula hawks are of particular interest. Cicada killers do exactly what you would think a venomous insect with that name would do. They sting cicadas and paralyze them with their venom and then fly back to their nest carrying the cicada. And then they lay eggs on the cicada, which will be eaten by the larvae that develop from the eggs. Cicada killers are solitary wasps who dig individual burrows in the dirt or sand. In fact, in some places they are called sand hornets, but they aren't actually hornets. And they generally do not build large colonies like murder hornets do. They are much less aggressive against humans, and in extremely rare occasions when they do sting a human, it is apparently not severe, described as just feeling like a pinprick. Tarantula hawks are similar to cicada killers in the sense that they are large wasps that are also comparable in size to murder hornets. All of these wasps can grow over 2 inches in length with 3-inch wingspans. Also similar to cicada killers, tarantula hawks have a life cycle that is particularly dependent on a specific species of prey. In this case, tarantula spiders. Female tarantula hawks will sting a tarantula, which again paralyzes the victim, which the female tarantula hawk will drag back to its burrow. And there, it will lay an egg on the tarantula and then close up the burrow. And the egg will eventually hatch into a larva, which then burrows into the tarantula's abdomen. And there, it will feed voraciously. The tarantula is still alive and still paralyzed. The scientific literature describes the larva purposely avoiding eating the spider's vital organs initially to keep it alive and therefore fresh as long as possible. So the tarantula spider is slowly eaten alive from the inside out, but is paralyzed and helpless the entire time. Sounds like an absolutely awful way to die. Of note, tarantula hawks do not get off scot-free here. Females have giant stingers and know how to use them, so most other animals leave them alone. But roadrunners, which is the iconic bird species here in the Southwest, known for their ability to run really fast, they are apparently able to eat tarantula hawks in large numbers without suffering any negative consequences. And such is the circle of life here in New Mexico. Our tarantula spiders are preyed upon by our tarantula hawks, our official state insect, by the way, who in turn are then preyed upon by our official state bird, the roadrunner. Tarantula hawks are of medical importance to humans because they have one of the most painful stings known among insects. Most sources rate their sting as either being the number one or number two most painful in the world, even more painful than murder hornets, according to some experts. Although the intense pain apparently does not last very long, in some cases only 5 minutes. And again, they are also not often aggressive towards humans, generally only stinging when they feel threatened in some way. So stings against humans are extremely rare. Like most bees and wasps, if you leave them alone, they will leave you alone. That is the social contract that we have had with our buzzing friends for thousands of years, and we should all do our best to honor that. So, overall, really good news on this front. The dreaded murder hornets were eradicated in the Pacific Northwest, and the other wasps of similar size that already live in the U.S. and Canada are generally disinterested in humans and have no natural inclination to attack us. There's always the chance that the murder hornets might come back, possibly the exact same way they got here in the first place, so ongoing surveillance will be important. It's also still possible that they weren't 100% eradicated the first time. Maybe they are just secretly in hiding, waiting to destroy human civilization when we least expect it. Probably not, but you never know. It is also worth noting that the Asian giant hornet has a cousin called simply the Asian hornet or yellow-legged hornet that is similarly aggressive and destructive against honeybee colonies and was recently found in the state of Georgia in the southeast United States in the summer of 2023. It was near the city of Savannah, which is a major seaport, leading experts to believe the hornets were accidentally transported on a container ship. And it's a significant find because this is the exact same species that arrived in France back in 2004, and from just a single queen multiplied into millions of hornets that are now spread all over Western Europe. So far, no nests have been discovered in North America, just individual hornets as far as I know, but definitely something worth keeping an eye on. So there you have it. That is the story, indeed the saga, of the invasion of the murder hornets. Sounds like a cheap horror movie coming soon to the discount DVD bin at your local Walmart. But it is one with a happy ending for North Americans, at least in the first episode, with possibly more to come in the future. So now let's move to the actual wilderness medicine portion of this Wilderness Medicine podcast. First, we are going to talk a little bit about the pathophysiology of wasp stings. Just a brief overview. There will be no balancing biochemical equations on a chalkboard or anything like that, I promise. And then we will review the presentation, evaluation, and management of an individual patient who suffers a wasp sting or multiple stings. The first thing to know is that there are many similarities between bee venom and wasp venom, but there are also some notable differences. All of the various different kinds of bee and wasp venoms are complex mixtures of many different chemicals. They all contain phospholipase A, hyaluronidase, and histamine. Melanin, which is a major cause of toxicity in bee venom, is not a significant component of most wasp venoms. Wasp venoms do include acetylcholine and serotonin, and several different kinds of catecholamines and also kinins. Acetylcholine, in particular, is thought to cause most of the excruciating pain at the sting site because it stimulates intense depolarization of the nociceptors in the dermis layer of the skin. But apparently, that was not enough pain and suffering for the wasps to inflict, so their venom contains other compounds, such as histamine and serotonin, that also trigger the nociceptors to cause even more terrible pain. Phospholipase A, specifically phospholipase A1 in most wasps, causes direct toxicity to cells by lysing cell membranes, and then the byproducts of this cell destruction can stimulate inflammation pathways in the body and also cause even more direct toxicity to other cells. But wait, there's more. Phospholipase is also suspected to be a major trigger of anaphylaxis by acting as an antigen and binding to IgE. Hyaluronidase, meanwhile, degrades the extracellular matrix and thus can cause significant local tissue damage. And there are many other chemical compounds that are capable of doing some damage to human bodies, too many to talk about all of them. It's worth mentioning that murder hornets have a neurotoxin in their venom that is unique to them, in addition to all of the ingredients mentioned above that are found in almost all wasp venoms. Now, this all sounds really terrible, and it is, but the good news is even the biggest, baddest hornets in the world are still relatively tiny compared to most human beings. And so the amount of venom injected in a single sting usually causes some local symptoms, but nothing else. Now, there are some situations in which a single sting can be dangerous or even deadly, such as anaphylaxis, which is actually the number one cause of human deaths from wasp stings in the United States, and we will talk more about that. There are also freak accidents, like someone getting stung inside their throat because they accidentally drank a wasp that was exploring an open can of soda at a picnic, or a person getting stung on the outside of the neck, but the venom gets injected directly into a blood vessel that flows straight to the brain, stuff like that. But by and large, a single sting, even from a murder hornet, will not be life-threatening or even close to that. So what will it look like? Let's say you are on a multi-day safari in the wilderness with a friend of yours who gets stung by a wasp, just a single sting. What can you expect? Well, individual wasp stings are categorized the same way that individual bee stings are. Far and away, the most common outcome is the small local reaction, which is usually defined as local pain with redness and swelling less than 5 centimeters in diameter. Typically, symptoms develop within minutes and resolve within hours, and that's it. And these account for something like 80 to 90% of all cases, depending on which studies you look at. Large local reactions are more severe, and they occur in about 10% of cases. The pain is more severe, and the symptoms last longer, usually peaking at about 48 hours and then slowly resolving over the course of 5 to 10 days total. The area of redness and swelling is larger than 5 centimeters in diameter, although some sources use 10 centimeters as the cutoff. And if you use the 10 centimeter threshold, that makes it all easier to remember. They occur in 10% of cases, are 10 centimeters in diameter, and resolve within 10 days. Systemic allergic reactions are the most dangerous of the three types, but also the most rare, accounting for less than 5% of cases. The most severe type of systemic allergic reaction is anaphylaxis. There are a few different criteria for diagnosing anaphylaxis, and different people will present with different signs and symptoms. You probably know most of these: a diffuse, itchy, raised, reddish rash anywhere on the body, gastrointestinal symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea, rapidly progressive swelling of the face, or even more worrisome, swelling of the airway, which may present as severe respiratory distress, dangerously low blood pressure, usually manifests as feeling dizzy or faint, or acute onset of altered mental status, or even worse, just abrupt collapsing from loss of consciousness. Any of these symptoms, or a combination of these symptoms, should be considered anaphylaxis until proven otherwise. And in a wilderness situation, and really even in the emergency department at the hospital, you are likely not going to prove otherwise. So just go ahead and call it anaphylaxis and proceed accordingly. These three classifications represent the possible presentations you might see in a patient with a single wasp sting or just a few wasp stings. There is one more scenario that we haven't talked about yet, which is the most dangerous of all, but fortunately is also the most rare, and that is the massive attack of wasps that leads to a massive envenomation event. This is usually defined as 50 or more stings, although with some wasp species, any number more than 5 or 10 can be worrisome, especially in small children. Now we are concerned about the direct toxicity of the venom. All of those components of wasp venom that we talked about that can cause toxicity, well, now they will cause that toxicity. And what kind of toxicity? Well, pretty much every kind of toxicity. A lot of scientific literature about massive wasp envenomations comes from Asia, particularly China and Japan. And one paper published in 2013 by a group of Chinese doctors included over 1,000 patients, which is a shockingly high number. These are not isolated wasp stings. These are massive attacks. So it's really sad to see so many victims. But having such a large sample size does provide us with some useful data. In this paper, with over 1,000 cases, they describe patients suffering severe hemolysis, myotoxicity, neurotoxicity, hepatotoxicity, and renal toxicity, among other things. They describe a syndrome of hyperinflammation and multi-organ dysfunction with coagulopathy, rhabdomyolysis, and acute kidney injury, and in several cases, profound shock. And again, this is not anaphylactic shock. The vast majority of their cases of shock were attributed to the direct toxicity of the venom. And not surprisingly, they found that patients who suffered more stings suffered more toxicity. So, how do we translate this? Well, these patients are going to look sick. Now, a lot of this pathology is going to progress over the course of days and sometimes weeks, with the patient hopefully being monitored in an ICU during that time. One of the most important points that I teach to my residents and fellows here at UNM when I am giving lectures about envenomations is that direct toxicity from the venom in the early stages can present very similar to anaphylaxis. These patients can look very toxic with altered mental status. They can appear to be in respiratory distress. They can have very abnormal vital signs, including hypotension. And in the moment, especially out in the wilderness, but also even in the hospital, you are not going to know with any degree of certainty exactly which pathological processes are happening. So the take-home point is to keep in mind that both processes are possible and have a low threshold to give epinephrine to treat empirically for anaphylaxis, in addition to all of the other treatments necessary to resuscitate the patient. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit talking about treatment. We are actually just finishing the presentation portion, so now let's move on to evaluation of the patient and then discuss more about management. To talk about evaluation, let's go back to you and your friend on the multi-day safari adventure in the wilderness. To start off, let's assume you are out hiking away from camp and many hours away from civilization, and your friend is stung by a single wasp. Now, let me just say this. Every time you encounter a new patient, you should be doing a quick BLS assessment. BLS referring to basic life support here in the United States. Other countries might call it something else. Most versions will start out with some kind of language about assess the situation or survey the scene for safety, something like that. And for good reason, in the case of any bite or sting injury, there might be a risk of another bite or sting injury occurring. And we never want the first rescuer to become a second victim. And especially with all the insects we have talked about in this podcast, they all send out an attack pheromone after stinging that can trigger a swarm of thousands of other insects from their colony to attack in the vicinity of where the first sting occurred. So that is important situational awareness. The next step is to assess the patient for responsiveness. In this case, your friend should be fully awake and alert. Especially if they just got stung by a wasp, I would expect them to be 110% awake and alert. And then move on to assessing the ABCs, airway, breathing, and circulation. Again, with just a single sting, we would expect the ABCs to be totally normal, although anaphylaxis is absolutely a possibility with just a single sting, and symptoms can occur very rapidly, so something to keep in mind. But statistically speaking, over 95% of patients are going to be just fine after a single sting. So no need to start CPR, and maybe you have another friend there with you who is excited to help and is hooking up an AED machine and trying to deliver shocks. You can probably tell him to stop that. So now what do we do? Well, it's probably time to actually look at the site of the sting. I keep saying that it is a single sting event, but do we know that? Wasps, unlike honeybees, can sting multiple times each. And maybe it was actually a honeybee after all, so worth checking to see if there is a retained stinger in the skin, and if so, remove it as quickly as possible. Red welts will appear at the site of each sting, usually within a few minutes. Sometimes a ring of redness will develop. There will be swelling of the surrounding tissue. As we talked about before, the difference between a small local reaction and a large local reaction is the extent of the spreading and the time course, with small local reactions usually resolving within hours and large local reactions progressing over the course of several days. But getting back to the initial assessment of your friend, it's worth asking a few questions. And when asked, most patients stung by wasps describe a very sharp pain followed by an intense burning sensation, and then later on a feeling of itchiness. Interestingly, almost all victims of murder hornets say the same thing. They describe it feeling like a red-hot nail or needle was being driven into their skin. Fortunately, the excruciating pain usually only lasts about 5 to 15 minutes, even when stung by a murder hornet. Obviously, the redness and swelling and itchiness will last longer than that. Murder hornet stings can also cause local tissue necrosis that leaves people with deep pitted scars on their skin, but that is a much later finding. And so now you are finishing your history and physical exam. Make sure you don't miss any other injuries. And this can go both ways. Sometimes the sting is the distracting injury because it is extremely painful, but then the victim is startled and stumbles and gets a deep cut that nobody is looking for because everyone is focused on the sting. On the other hand, maybe you hear a scream and see your friend falling out of a tree and he hits a rock, causing major blunt trauma. And then he rolls off the rock and falls in a river, and now there is a dramatic water rescue. In a case like that, it would be very easy to miss the fact that it was a wasp sting that caused him to fall out of the tree in the first place. So just keep that in mind, that everyone involved, the victim and rescuers, can all be distracted in either direction, either towards or away from a sting injury. So use your best judgment when completing your survey of a patient and try not to miss one injury because you were distracted by another. Management of wasp stings out in the field is pretty straightforward. The only wound care you need to do is just a quick wash with soap and water or hand sanitizer or an alcohol swab, whatever you have on you. Ibuprofen is a good choice for pain management because it is also an anti-inflammatory medication, and you can give it to children as young as 6 months old. You can also add an antihistamine like cetirizine or diphenhydramine, which are available over the counter and are frequently carried by a lot of people who have allergies. Remember, this is a multi-day safari, and so you are checking up on your friend slash patient frequently. And if the redness and swelling keep spreading on day 2 and day 3, this is suggestive of a large local reaction. If you haven't given any antihistamines yet, I would definitely start them now. Topical steroids are usually widely available, and in some countries, oral steroids like dexamethasone can be purchased over the counter in small quantities. And if you are carrying any of those, they would certainly be worth using for a large local reaction. Now, you will see spreading redness and swelling and be tempted to treat your patient for cellulitis. For bee stings, this is almost never necessary, but for wasps, the answer isn't 100% certain. Wasps feast on rotten fruit and rotten meat, like hamburgers and hot dogs found in the garbage cans at the park. And so theoretically, there is an increased risk of bacterial infection from them. That said, their saliva and venom both contain natural antibiotics, and so a lot of experts feel like that risk isn't much to worry about. For me, I will consider oral antibiotics if the area of redness and swelling is also tender to palpation, which it shouldn't be if it isn't infected. And other things like fever spikes or the site continuing to worsen after 48 hours would also probably warrant antibiotic coverage. If the patient shows any signs of anaphylaxis, hopefully you have access to an epinephrine injector. It might be called an adrenaline injector in your country. Have a low threshold to use it. If you have oral steroids and antihistamines, definitely give them, but they are adjunct medications for anaphylaxis. They are not the definitive life-saving treatment that the patient needs right then. These patients are at risk for rebound anaphylaxis because the trigger is still there, injected into their body. So they might need multiple doses of epinephrine. If you only have one injector, there are videos on the internet explaining how to partially disassemble an injector and manually give more doses of the residual epinephrine that is left in the chamber after the first dose is given. This is obviously unconventional and controversial. Most people agree that it is a last resort to be used only when a person is at risk of dying in the wilderness and you have no other options. Every patient who receives any amount of epinephrine needs to be taken emergently to the nearest hospital, especially if you are MacGyvering epi injectors out in the woods. That's a pretty strong sign that the situation calls for a higher level of care. The other scenario that also requires a higher level of care is a massive envenomation event. For bees, the numbers for toxic and lethal doses are reported as, 700 stings or 1,000 stings or 1,300 stings, depending on the source. For wasps, the numbers are much smaller. In some cases, as few as 10 stings have caused significant toxicity in full-grown adults, and 40 to 50 stings can be fatal. Each species of wasp is a little different, but generally speaking, their venom is more toxic than bees, and they inject larger volumes of it when they sting. As you might guess, wasp stings are even more dangerous in smaller children. So, for massive attacks, give the medications that are available to you, including epinephrine if needed, and support airway, breathing, and circulation as best as you can out in the field. And then definitely get these patients to the closest emergency department as soon as possible. These are situations in which you can really, truly save somebody's life out in the wilderness by recognizing a serious medical emergency and providing appropriate care out in the field, and then transporting the patient to a hospital as quickly as possible. And really, that is what wilderness medicine is all about. So thank you for taking the time to listen to another episode of the AWLS podcast. My name is Matt Gunderson, and this concludes my series on Hymenoptera stings. I have enjoyed sharing it with you, and I hope you found it interesting and useful in some way. Until next time, best wishes, and be safe out there.